The spoke committees, and there are multiple spoke committees that are going to be working on this issue because obviously it crosses a variety of areas. So the spoke committees will make the recommendation to the hub committee. The hub committee, my understanding is, will make the recommendation to you. So essentially, I think if this, the board has a direction, you're going to share that direction with us and we're going to move forward. If you don't have a direction at this point in time, we're still going to be having and engaging in those conversations because we know that that is a decision point that we are obligated to provide to the hub and the hub is obligated to provide to you.
It's kind of circular. Steve and I both agree that it would be helpful to start thinking about this now, particularly if there's some very strong feelings one way or the other, so that there's just some level of communication rather than a surprise come January.
Well, and sorry.
I just have a quick question. Dr. Scheffel brought up a few months ago, I'm a little confused on, I thought kindergartners had to take
the part. They don't take the part.
So the CMAS PARC ELA assessments start in grade 3.
So when we talk about these three years, are we talking about starting in third grade?
Correct.
Oh. I'm sorry, I missed that part.
It's pretty easy to confuse, actually.
I'm always confused. I stay confused.
I don't think the READAC comes into our ESSA deliberations at all.
READAC is state legislation.
And isn't it true that we would be you'd be doing this research and coming up with guidelines based on how students perform on the access and maybe some other test, but at least that test? Because we know that the readability on the PARC is at a certain level, so they have to have the language comprehension orally at that level, at least at a threshold level, to feel like the results would be valid and reliable. Otherwise, then they probably should wait. So, I mean, I think even though it sounds really complicated, there's good data to drive. Are you ready to at least gain some benefit for teachers by taking the PARC?
So that's some feedback, obviously, the guidelines and all that sort of stuff we'd love to hear about, and what the different potential measures are, whether it's just access or if somebody else has another brilliant idea. Thank you, and safe travels.
Thank you.
Thank you, Joyce. And thank you for suggesting that was discussed today.
Well, and we'll try to bring back other things as we think of them. I don't think Steve and I were quite tuned into that. Oops, sorry. Of how we could be effective giving you guys a report, and then I don't think we thought carefully enough about our giving feedback back to folks if in fact we have some concerns, but let's make sure we do that. I think it'll be helpful to everybody, and I think it's a respectful way to treat all these folks who are working extremely hard. They've got meetings, they've given us reports. The Colorado education community and the broader community is definitely stepping up to this. I was in a meeting this morning where ESSA was also a topic, and they are getting ready to host another listening tour come January. So I think we have a lot of support, even in the business community, for interaction and feedback. Mm-hmm. Sorry, Patrick, go ahead.
No problem. So next on our agenda is Colleen O'Neill. She might look a little familiar to you. And then also with her is Jennifer Simons, who's our state Title II coordinator, ESEA Title II coordinator. And they're going
to... So describe Title II to those of us who don't walk around with this permanently tattooed.
It's a fairly large ES Elementary and Secondary Education Act program. For Colorado, we receive around $25 million annually. The majority of that flows to school districts. The intent is that it supports quality teachers and quality principals, moves them to effectiveness and professional development activities.
Right. And so it's not the part of the
retention.
Money. It's not the part of the money that's for the kids directly so much as it is for the districts to support quality teaching.
It supports teachers in their efforts to increase their ability to provide effective instruction to all students.
Okay, and there's going to be a test in February. Regarding Title I, Title II, right, Patrick?
You got it.
You're the only one's going to pass it.
Yeah. Maybe a screener would be helpful. With no further ado, here's Colleen and Jennifer on effective instruction and leadership.
Good afternoon. I think we've transitioned to afternoon outside of this morning. So I'm going to talk about a couple of things. One, the process first, and then how we came to some recommendations that we are talking a little bit about with the ESSA Hub. And then we open it up for a lot of feedback that we can take back to our spoke committee tomorrow as well. So very first piece of this is in the ESSA state plan development is really around how did we form this particular group, which I think is important. So we are tasked with really, again, the educator kind of talent piece of ESSA, and I think it's important to know that we're looking at provisions that were formerly known, and I keep saying that it's like Prince, the artist formerly known as Prince, but provisions formerly known under title as highly qualified provisions that were associated with No Child Left Behind. And so we'll get a little bit more deeply into that. But as we have our conversation today, I really want to frame that because I think it's really important that you understand that there's a transition here between highly qualified, which were the provisions under No Child Left Behind that very clearly stated that all of our teachers had to demonstrate content in field or content expertise in some way or another, and not necessarily associated with a license, but content expertise were the highly qualified provisions. So what we'll be talking a little bit about is the formerly known pieces of highly qualified. Our spoke committee very specifically, I'll click through really quickly because I think you understand the hub and spoke concept that was developed, so I'll go through very quickly. This spoke actually consists of multiple entities from the Colorado Education Association to district level representation to teacher level representation. This is not a spoke committee that was already formed. It came together solely for the purpose of reviewing the ESSA provisions that are in front of us for effective leadership provisions associated with that. So we started meeting at the beginning of August, August 4th to be exact. We've been able to have two large group meetings and then two working groups. So this particular spoke broke off into three individual working groups in order to kind of tackle the big questions with regard to ESSA that we were working on. We have another meeting tomorrow and then another meeting scheduled for November with some flexibility within that. And again, this is a group from across the state. We have a superintendent on board as well. And they are all tasked with coming together, having the conversation, and then going back to their constituents, having the conversation with them, and then bringing it back to the table. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the outreach of this spoke committee, too. With that, I will go ahead and get straight into what the effective instruction and leadership key points were with ESSA. Again, keep in mind a little bit of a frame around the former provisions of highly qualified. So under the Every Student Succeeds Act, we are tasked in this spoke very specifically with some very clear definitions around three items. Number one is experienced and inexperienced teachers. What is the Colorado definition or the recommendation for a definition around what an experienced teacher is and what an inexperienced teacher is? In the next couple of slides, I'm going to go through exactly what kind of the recommendations have been to this point, some unintended consequences and intended consequences of that, and then I would like to open it up for just conversation around what that means as the recommendations so we can take it back to the hub. So experienced, inexperienced, the other one that has been a little bit more controversial than any of the other pieces have actually been in field and out of field. Again, this is really the essence of highly qualified that's transitioning over into ESSA. In field and out of field is very clearly identified as in public reporting for the United States Department of Education. It is very clearly says that we need to identify educators who are not teaching in the subject area or field for which the teacher is certified or licensed. That is a very important direct quote from the ESSA law. So when we report, when we talk about in-field and out-of-field teachers, we are very clearly talking about people who are teaching in the subject or field in which the teacher is not certified or licensed. Okay, so, and we'll talk a little bit about what licensing actually means as well for us. We are also tasked with defining effective and ineffective educators. That one was a little bit easier for us to have a conversation about because we have Senate Bill 191 and the definition of effective educators. There are four other items that this group is working on, and these are more, these are not as clear definitions that we needed, but these are more regulatory in nature with regard to the supports that the Colorado Department of Education offers. And that is CD was asked, or CD's identified use of Title I and II in support of districts to strengthen teachers. This is really when we talked about the title definition that Pat just talked about. It's really about strengthening teachers, principals, and leaders and their ability to identify and support students with learning needs. So that's really about increasing our educators' ability to meet student needs. It's also about identifying the use of Title I and Title II funds. I switched those on the PowerPoint, I apologize. Title I and Title II funds in support of districts, again, really about educator talent and the support around that. And then CD's support of local districts to implement the educator evaluation systems. And the conversation, again, is around how does CDE provide those supports? So those are the recommendations that the spoke is coming back with. Are they similar to the way that we do it today, or is it a little bit different with some nuances? And then the spoke was also tasked with the definition of paraprofessional standards and the demonstration of meeting those standards. Today, you will not hear a lot about the paraprofessional standards because this is something that the spoke is still really grappling with. Paraprofessionals in the state of Colorado, there is no licensing requirement for paraprofessionals. It has always fallen underneath our highly, not always, but since the early 2000s, fallen underneath No Child Left Behind and the highly qualified provisions that basically said that our instructional paraprofessionals in our title schools needed to demonstrate additional content knowledge by either taking some college classes and or passing the Work Keys assessment to be able to be in a title school. ESSA basically has remanded all of those provisions, including the paraprofessionals and the educators, back to Colorado state law regarding teacher licensure. Again, Colorado has no licensure requirements. Other states do actually have licenses for their paraprofessionals. Colorado does not. We have relied solely on the essence of highly qualified for those provisions. Today, you will not hear much about that because the spoke group is still grappling a little bit with what does that mean as we go forward with this work under ESSA. As it stands today, these are the recommendations that the spoke is seeking feedback on with regard to the critical questions that we just put in front of you about inexperienced, effective, and out of field. The recommendations today say that we would define inexperienced as educators with 0 to 2 years of teaching experience in any educational setting. As we look at it today, or as we reported, it's really 3 years of teaching experience, which is our initial teacher license. Have it for 3 years. You need to take induction to be able to move to a professional license. The course of the conversation with 0 to 2 has very much been focused on there is a difference between inexperienced or brand new teachers to the profession, early career teachers, and professional teachers who are a little bit more veteran, who have professional licenses, who have been in the teaching arena for a longer period of time. So right now, the spoke's recommendation going forward is we don't think that a 0 to 3, that a 0 teacher, meaning I'm brand new and I'm 2 months into the school year, is the same as a third year teacher, that a 0 to 2 is more equitable, and then really talking about early career teachers, the support systems and the mentoring and the systems within the educational setting are clearly very different in our spoke's mind around 0 to 2, 3 to 5, which is the early career span, and then 5 and upwards trajectory for our veteran teachers. So as it stands today, that is the recommendation, is how we would define it for federal reporting to the United States Department of Education. And I think it's important to note that this is about how are we reporting to the United States Department of Education under the ESSA law about experienced or inexperienced educators.
Some additional context to these terms that we're charged with defining and how they will be used specifically. These three here of inexperienced and out of field and ineffective are used to meet the requirement that states and LEAs ensure that low-income and minority students specifically are not taught at disproportionate rates by these teachers who meet this definition of either inexperienced or out of field or ineffective. So Colleen had mentioned earlier that we do already have a requirement in the law to report teachers who are teaching out of the field or subject area in which they're licensed or endorsed. This other term of out of field, which sounds very similar, is used a little differently in ensuring that equitable access to teachers. So this is where we get the flexibility to define that differently if we wish, or to use it the same way that it is for the reporting of licensed or endorsed in that subject area. So just some context on how we would be using these terms once we define them. I don't think we made it very clear in the slides.
Thank you. Perfect. Okay, so with that context, I'm going to move on to the definition of infield, and again, the recommendation right now is the spoke is seeking feedback on, and I'm going to go right back really quickly to that reporting requirement that says that these individuals, as we define infield, it's about teachers not teaching in the subject area for which the teacher is certified or licensed. Because of that statement very clearly, and much debate within the spoke about what this means. In field right now is the recommendation is that we define in field as holding a license with an endorsement in the subject area in which the teacher is assigned to teach. So I always try to give my example of Colleen O'Neill, the licensed and endorsed English teacher teaching even one section of math. I would be considered out of field because I do not have an endorsement in math. Now, there are multiple pathways to seek an endorsement, including 24 credit hours by degree by content assessment under Colorado State statute as it stands today. So that recommendation today is that we would define them as individuals who are licensed and endorsed. Yeah. Dr. Scheffel?
How does this affect people that are coming into teaching as a second career and may have, in other words, they would still be viewed as inexperienced even though maybe they're an engineer and they've done a lot with math and they're alternatively licensed or they're working on it or something. Mm-hmm. Or they're working in a charter and they don't have to be licensed. Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much for the question. I think there's two different answers to that. One is that it was defined for inexperienced, 0 to 2 experienced teaching in any educational setting. And we defined that kind of broadly for a reason, because we do have many charter school teachers that come to us that do not have a license and or some other form of educational experience. I think there's more conversation to be had around that as well. They would fall into that category of 0 to 2. As it stands today, they also fall into that category of inexperience. So it would be actually make it a little bit smaller, because now it's 0 to 3 that they would fall into the category. We would be making that category just a smidge smaller with a 0 to 2.
Nothing wrong. I just want to add something to that, in that so the 0 to 2 would be determined locally as to the LEA makes the decision as looking at this person's record, how many years of experience they really have and what they choose to count. So it's not tied to how long they've held a license. We collect this data in the human resources collection and the LEA inputs it themselves. So they make the decision of whether or not they want to count years of teaching in a private school. They could make that decision, or they could decide not to count those years. It would be up to them.
Go ahead. But what if they're like an engineer and they've worked in a corporation and they've done corporate training or something? Mm-hmm. I suppose you could count that as a case. But let's say they haven't. Mm-hmm. I mean, are they still going to be put in a bucket of inexperienced? Is there a way to have a caveat saying, or, I don't know, professional experience? I mean, you know, it's different mm-hmm. if you're dealing with somebody who's 20 and they haven't had that much life experience, somebody that's been in the military and done a lot of things, and I hate to see them dubbed inexperienced.
And I think, thank you for that comment. I think we need to take it back to the spoke and have a conversation around that. I'll be very honest, in educator licensing, we do use that experience, and especially for our career and technical education expertise, and then adjunct and or any of our junior ROTC educators, we definitely use that. So I think it's well worth the conversation to go back and say, when we say educational setting, how do we define that? And there could be guidelines. We're not required to submit that into the ESSA plan, exactly what those guidelines could be, but we can absolutely come back and kind of define that from the Colorado Department of Education standpoint of, hey, by the way, when you determine this at a local education level, here are some of the guidelines that you can use to determine what an educational setting truly is. We have the same experience with actually our early childhood educators who are teaching in preschools that they not have to have a license, but have had 15 years of teaching in a preschool setting. So thank you.
It doesn't mean they can't teach. It's just a matter, it's a matter of equity for kids, yeah, so that poor children don't disproportionately have inexperienced, ineffective, out-of-field teachers. It doesn't say that they're not going to be allowed to teach. I sort of went down the wrong rabbit hole on that one for a little while, too, until I realized it was about balancing that out among our students rather than saying you can't teach poor kids or something like that.
Thank you very much for saying that, because I think that brings us back to we had the hub. We had this conversation with the hub, It's really important to distinguish between these two things. And we have some incredibly talented team members that are sitting behind me, Mary Bivens and Dr. Karen Martinez, who also were at the hub. And Mary pointed out to that team that this is not about hiring. Nothing in this work that the Spoke is doing is about who you can hire. That is not the case at all. So if I was the Chief Human Resources Officer in Greeley again, I could hire an individual that did not have an endorsement in math. I could do that. This is about the reporting to the United States Department of Education in order to ensure equitable access.
That's the short way of saying it.
Equitable access. Jennifer has it memorized better than I do in the exact quote, about ensuring equitable access. So I think really important to distinguish the two. So thank you for bringing that up.
I have the same problem.
You can hire.
Reporting.
Pam, go ahead. Sorry.
Thank you. Here's my concern. I appreciate what you're saying. You're trying to make sure that we understand that this doesn't mean we don't want teachers that don't have licenses. But that is exactly what I'm concerned about, because if the DOA or the DOE wants to know how many schools are not providing equitable access, and if that is being defined as not having in-field teachers, I am concerned about that. I think we have charter schools, we have rural and small schools that are really struggling to find teachers, and they do need to hire that local pharmacist to teach the science class, and for that school to then be put in the bucket of not providing equitable access, I don't think that's the road we want to go down. For instance, charter school teachers, or they don't even have a license, but maybe they have a bachelor's degree in engineering.
They're probably in field. No question at all about that.
I want to make sure that we are going to build a definition that provides for that kind of flexibility, even though they don't have a license.
Thank you.
That's
my concern.
Yes, and we definitely hear that concern, and we're taking back to our Spoke Committee on Friday sort of this topic again to kind of explore an additional menu of options. Do we really want to just have this one definition? Do we want to have an alternative definition in different contexts? Or do we want to give everyone the same menu of options similar to what Highly Qualified offered? I don't think we went down that road in that direction when we first had this discussion with them, and it's something that we still need to explore with the Spoke Committee.
Thank you.
Joyce?
So let me get this straight. We have a requirement by the federal government through ESSA to provide these labels. Is that correct?
To provide the reporting, yes.
To provide the reporting,
yes,
of labels for these teachers. Basically, that's the bottom line. So even if we don't have that, does this only apply to Title I, Title II schools, Title I, Title II teachers? If it's a school that doesn't have those students, then they don't get labeled. Is that correct? Is it just the teachers in those specific situations that have the labels?
So it's actually in any district that accepts the funds.
Okay, so everybody gets the label.
Yes, yes.
I'm starting to get a handle on this.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's consistent.
I have to go back to what Board Member Mazanik just said. I mean, the flexibility that we have already built in Colorado, I see, maybe not right now, but it looks like, to use your words, that rabbit hole. And that is very disturbing to me because of rural Colorado and because of what we are strapped. I mean, look at DPS, 900 teachers they have to hire. I can't imagine that. But out in Dove Creek, one teacher, it's just as serious to get a new teacher as it is for 900 here in DPS. Mm-hmm. So this is extremely concerning to me at the rural mm-hmm. and charter school level.
Thank you. We've heard that very clearly. We have a very clear 50-50 split on this one. I'll be very honest, in the field, in all of the SA tour and feedback that we've heard, as well as the multiple groups that we've gone to, a kind of a 50-50 split. I do want to make note that when we talk about licensing, it is alternative license pathways, and it is what you would consider more traditional four-year licensure pathways. And I think that has not been incredibly clear to folks either. So there is still absolutely a mechanism to bring individuals in through the alternative license. Alternative licenses simply require you to have a bachelor's degree and then demonstrate a content knowledge through 24 credit hours, assessment, and or degree. And so this does not prohibit, again, it's not a hiring requirement.
It's a labeling.
Here's what I would like to know. You say it's kind of a 50-50 split. The 50% who would like to define these mm-hmm. teachers as out of field, they think that makes sense to call all those charter school teachers who don't have a license and all the rural that don't have a license but are qualified to teach that subject, they are okay with calling them out of field?
So yes and no. I mean, I will take it back to the spoke and listen more clearly to what their description of it is. What they are looking at it through is the equity lens. And again, is everybody on the same playing field? So has the learning, professional learning, been the same for individuals coming in with the pedagogy and the content knowledge? And have they been able to demonstrate the content knowledge needed? Just for a little data purposes, we have approximately 4,000 charter school educators. Of that, about a quarter of them are licensed. That's the opposite way. Thank you. Three-quarters of them are licensed. I'm like, wait a minute, that's not right. It's the opposite way. About approximately three-quarters are actually licensed. So a lot of times we've been trying really hard to get data in front of our spoke as well so that there is not anomalies or outliers, that we are targeting the general population of our educators. And then what pathways do we have to bring educators in? Because we definitely know that we, as we describe this and as the spoke has had the conversation, the rural conversation in the context has been predominant conversation, definitely. So we'll take that back.
So are you telling me, though, that they're saying, because there's three quarters of them are already licensed, are you telling me that the thinking is, well, that quarter that isn't, they can go an alternative route?
Actually, I think I did not clarify that well. I'm doing a really good job of that today. I'm going to take licensing off of the plate because Colorado statute says that all educators will have a license. So I'm going to take licensing off of the plate because that is what statute. So we function very clearly under statute provisions, and then if there's recommendations, the waivers can come outside of that. And so we pulled licensing off because we felt like the conversation was more about should we be hiring licensed teachers rather than endorsed or content demonstrated content teachers. So I think there's a conundrum associated with that, is that we're requiring from statute all educators to be licensed, which then requires them to have an endorsement. So therefore, when we look at the definition of not teaching in the subject or field in which the teacher is certified or licensed, there is a conundrum associated with that and a real push-pull, because then there's waiver statutes that says I don't have to hire a licensed teacher, and there's multiple pathways to bring them in under a license, including the alternative pathways. So I think the spoke has more to struggle with, and we'll take back that conversation. And then, of course, the hub has more to struggle with, and our general population, as we start to define these, I think have more to struggle with, and the recommendations that will come out.
So let me suggest another scenario.
Yes.
Small school district. Small school district has three high schoolers who want to take calculus, and they take an online calculus course, and that course is being taught by a not only licensed but experienced, effective, in content area teacher for that course. And then there's also a teacher on site. How are we what do we expect then from that on-site teacher? What credentials does that individual have to have in order to be mentoring and helping the kids, interacting with the real online teacher, et cetera? In other words, we are having, in my opinion, we're having this conversation as though we are continuing to teach the way we've always taught, which is that there's a teacher in the classroom. And yet we know that even in large districts, we have different scenarios, but certainly in our rural school districts, I think we believe that we can give a very high-quality education to all our kids because we can personalize, we can use online. In the same way, our teachers who need more content, who are rural, can pick it up online. In other words, it's a different, I think it should be a different environment, so that we really raise the opportunities for kids. And now we're trying to figure out, well, what kind of identified credentials do we want to have? This is a bigger picture than ESSA. Mm-hmm. ESSA is about equity, but we're not even, I'm not sure we're really sure what are the needs for the people with a pulse who are with our kids, in addition to the highly qualified educators who are putting together some of these fantastic courses for kids that are super engaging and knock the socks off.
So this actually, I appreciate that you brought this up, because this was already coming up as we were continuing to enforce highly qualified, because there would be questions from rural districts as to essentially how to code these people in the human resources collection. And I think it is an equity question, because if you are giving those students access to an experienced, effective, instructor virtually that isn't an employee of the district, we have no way of showing that, because we're only asking them to report to us who the employees are. State law would say that the person with the pulse in the room has to have a license, and that it doesn't matter what their endorsement is or anything like that, because I would tell them, encoding them, they're essentially a study hall teacher. They're not teaching that calculus course. The person, across the state or across the country is. But I think you're right. I think we need to have a way of showing when districts are getting creative about how to provide that equitable access and giving them access to experts in the content area. And we don't currently have that. And I think that
could
be a discussion
for the school
committee.
Well, and some of those folks are not really study hall teachers. They're definitely somewhere beyond there. Mm-hmm. This gets a little simpler for elementary teachers, but nevertheless, I think we need to think differently. And who's been messing with this idea of how to identify? I don't know what the right word is. How to identify, classify these folks?
Yeah, and we agree, and we'll take it back to the spoke, have more conversation. I think it is a larger conversation for sure. About how are we looking at, for lack of a better term, highly qualified educators, and what does that mean, and our statutes. So I think there is a much larger conversation just around educators and educator pathways, and I think Ms. Goff actually made a reference to this earlier even about the Educator Licensing Act 1991. So we will put that on the table for another conversation and know
that except we have to have a plan, folks.
We have to have
like,
a plan.
I'd like to really encourage flexibility for this flexible new ESSA on this.
I thank you very much. We'll definitely...
To the extent that equity is maintained, the problem with flexibility has been a lack of equity, and we're trying to
balance
work around that.
That's the rub.
Were there more comments back here? Sorry.
Is it better to, or did they entertain this concept of defining experience in field and effective, and then outside of those parameters by default is inexperienced, out of field, ineffective, as opposed to defining it this way, inexperienced, because it just seems too black and white. I mean, somebody, why 0 to 2 years? Why not 0 to 1 years or 0 to 6 months? I mean, it seems it would be better to, if we're going to get like the richness of what these words could mean, experience means this or this or this or this, or two of six things or something. Is that too complicated?
It is absolutely not.
Why did we land on that approach?
It's absolutely not too complicated. We landed on this because ESSA in and of itself talks about the antithesis instead right. of the other side. So right. we talk about it as inexperienced, ineffective, out of field, and it is throughout the ESSA conversation. As we actually have conversations in our spoke, we talk about it the opposite direction yeah. and then kind of go back and define it. It was part of the early career conversation as well. Is it really about inexperienced or is it early career? Everyone starts a career somewhere. And we don't define everybody as inexperienced. We define them as novice or beginning professionals or something along that line. We are stuck with the ESSA conversation around the verbiage itself, but not the concept at all.
We could land on what do we want to see for experienced mm-hmm. in field effective right. teachers, and then the converse of that by default is someone Great. Who doesn't meet that threshold.
Okay.
Maybe.
We'll take that one back too.
Okay. That way we could build in flexibility because mm-hmm. we could say there are five different ways of showing experience.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Appreciate that. Thank you. Okay.
Forward. Thank you. Keep going.
I'm going to drop to very quickly run over this and hope that it works out. The definition of effective is the standard definition
as
Senate... As Senate Bill 191. I think I need the chocolate over here. I'm not sure. Okay. Thanks, Pat. I appreciate it. Okay.
Notice that Thursday afternoons just get a little...
It just makes me feel better to know that it's closer. Okay. So we have defined our definition of effective, ineffective today as the definition of Senate Bill 191 of less than effective educators. Outside of that, I want to be conscientious of time. I would really like to be able to kind of skip a little bit to our unintended and intended consequences of at least the three big things that we've talked about, because then I'd really like to kind of wrap up with, are there any other things that we really need to be thinking about in more detail as we go forward with the spoke and especially with our conversations tomorrow? So some potential unintended consequences, and I think you've already brought several of these up, to be perfectly honest about our in-field educators, is we have a couple of questions around, because we have a statute that says all teachers will be licensed, all educators will be licensed, that means our teachers, our special service professionals, and our principals. It does not apply to our superintendents. What do we do with the out-of-field, and I think that was already brought up earlier, the out-of-field with regard to the waivers of charter schools and or districts. So something for us to grapple with, continuing. The discussion question that we really have is, should we be identifying a unique definition or a waiver for those individuals? So the question has come forward, if we define out of field or in field as an endorsed licensed educator, then should we also be going back and saying, what does it mean when you have waived so that there are not unintended consequences associated with the reporting? Because remember, again, this is not about hiring. I can hire whomever I think is the best fit for my kids at the local education agency level. This is about reporting. So the question is, if we were to define in-field as licensed and endorsed, and we know for a fact we have individuals that have waivers in which licensing does not apply, nor does endorsement apply, then is there another way for us to report that so that there is not a negative connotation associated with those individuals. That is something that we're continuing to grapple with, and quite honestly, we don't know what will work for the United States Department of Education as we go forward with that, but that was part of the conversation and the discussion questions for the spoke, which would honor a little bit of both of those sides. I think we have more conversation that has come from the board at this point as well. So I'm going to pause for just a second and get any reaction or responses to that of can we define it a little bit differently for two different groups.
Joyce.
Let me get one thing real clear. Sure. This in-field and out-of-field are not our terms. Those are the USDOE terms, right?
Those are the terms that are used in SAS.
Okay. So are there other states grappling with this that we could call and say, how are you handling this, and might that give us another...
Call another state, say, give us the answer.
We actually did. I was hoping another state had already solved this for us. The difference is many other states already have in license or in their Colorado revised, not their Colorado
their
revised statutes. So
yeah.
That would have solved the problem for us. But in their statutes that it is actually licensed and endorsed, and it's a hiring qualification. So many other states actually are not grappling with the same conversation that we're having because they actually already had it in law. ESSA remanded it back to the law. We're grappling with it a little bit differently because of that. And also some states do have waivers where there's no licenses required. Utah is an example today. And there are other states where there is absolutely no waiver applicability at all, nor charter schools. So South Dakota has no charter schools. So it's a little bit all over the map and the continuum.
But no, there's no one that has this.
Nuances because if they do not have it in their law, they don't have waivers.
I see. Okay.
So you see that it's a little bit of a of a mixture. Okay.
Yep.
But we don't have to define infield as holding a license and endorsement, right?
We don't have to. We have to report it as such. So this is the catch, and this is a little bit of a new conversation, and that is the problem, right? So the phrase... Go for it.
So this comes up in two different places in the law. So in one place in the law, it requires states to report a number of things about teacher qualifications, percent of teachers on emergency licensure, and then there's one requirement of reporting teachers who are teaching out of the subject area in which they are licensed or certified is how it's worded. But then in the other place in the law where it talks about equitable access to teachers, it uses the term out of field when we're talking about ensuring that low-income and minority students are not taught at disproportionate rates by these labeled teachers of ineffective, out of field, inexperienced. And so that's where it's not, so when it talks about reporting the percentage of teachers who are not licensed in their subject area, that's very clear, and the way it's worded, it has to be our endorsements. But then in this other place where it obligates states and districts to ensure that equity is in place, basically we have an opportunity to define it differently, to maybe make it more flexible, to give that menu of options. Or we can be consistent and just say it's an endorsement. So far, that's been the recommendation from the spoke committee, but I think all these additional concerns that have been raised are ones that maybe they haven't considered, and we want to continue that conversation with them.
Yeah, because I think that just historically, when you look at an entity with as much influence as the federal government, you know, that these metrics, though they may seem innocuous and we're just reporting, turn into a ding, you know, like we've got X number of percent of teachers that are just out of field and they're not licensed. Mm-hmm. Well, so we want to be able to say, well, right, if you define experience and in field merely as a license, but we have these other four ways that we believe, so we're trying to accomplish equity, but we're also trying to say a license doesn't guarantee a person's graded teaching. We know that. Mm-hmm. And so to use that as a proxy, I think, puts us in kind of a bad position because people may use it against us. So I just think we need to look down the road and say, how might they use this metric if we just kind of fall into that?
I agree, and we have some evidence that already speaks to that it's about the equity gaps. So if they do define it, then it is about achievement and the gaps in achievement. So if there's low achievement and we see that it's inexperienced, ineffective, out of field, That's where it becomes a little bit of a conversation. So
I think
it may make sense to define differently.
Yeah, it seems like we could meet their need to ensure equity while still meeting our need to say these categories, mm-hmm. we don't want them to mm-hmm. define what we're doing here. If we can show experience mm-hmm. and in-field experience and effectiveness.
Mm-hmm. So. Thank you. Yes, Pam.
Remind me when the plan... We'll have another opportunity to talk about this, or several opportunities. Yeah.
Multiple.
We have a long ways to go before.
Are we
the
thinking
state
January?
Plan.
Are you guys going to give up your holidays and just write?
That's the way it's shaping up.
Jane just said, "Which year?"
Which year?
Yeah.
Plural.
So I guess the discussions I've heard, I guess it was at the Hub Committee meeting, is that it's unlikely that we'll get an extension of time to submit plans. There's just a possibility that they'll allow for a year for implementation. Is that?
And we're looking at the.
Is that what you're hearing also? Remember, there were 20,000 responses to the rules.
Yeah, I think there's a chance that what they'll say is we just need to submit assurances in March, by March or July, and that we will have additional time to submit our full-blown plan, or that they might break it up into parts, that we need certain parts by certain dates. But I do think that there's a chance that, that there will be a delay in what we need to submit and by when we need to submit it.
But in the meantime, go ahead.
But we're still sort of operating on the assumption that we need to submit.
But yep. We did hear from Steve, our chair, who said that he wanted it by March. So that's kind of...
Well, that's a bit of insurance. And I think that I find that very reasonable, that we should shoot for that. Mm-hmm.
We will definitely be back. We will take this back to the SPOC. If we need to add additional meetings, we will be adding additional meetings. We are slated to go back to the Hub as well. And I think we're looking at potentially December to go back to the Hub, because there was a lot of feedback. And we want folks to be able to send this out to their constituency. Mm-hmm. We need to hear from the hiring managers and from the teachers and from the Rural Alliance and from the team members that are out in the field more aggressively as well.
Joyce,
I just have a quick question. Are all of our districts Title I or Title II or combinations? Are there any that fit outside of this?
We have a couple that are not Title I. I think all districts are now eligible for Title I. We have one or two that declined.
Okay, so this is going to affect.
This really is everyone.
I just mm-hmm. wanted to double.
It really is everyone. Okay.
Jane?
I would suggest that we be as clear as we can after each one of these spoke conversations who this applies to, because we have a huge Title I, Title II coming up for, and whatever the newer one is. Title conversations and how they apply, but I'm in respectful of any clarifying questions today from us to, does this apply teacher-wise, educator-wise only to Title I, Title II schools, statewide or otherwise, or is this general teachers in this case, or educator labels, better word to use today than that. I don't like it, but that's the words we have. But it is, and that's what I think is going to be really important, and maybe we all should make a point before every conversation we start, mm-hmm. Not only these that are broadcast and recorded and kept, but in our communities and everywhere, that, you know, just a couple little high point, talking point reminders, because this work applies to all of us. You know, we got public schools in general, K-12, and charter. That includes our mm-hmm. charter schools and, you know, our other entities. And particularly today, today's point is the teacher thing. Mm-hmm. We're talking about only Title I, Title II, or we're on the big, broad level here with certain parts of these spoke topics. Mm-hmm. So I would appreciate that. Thank you for the work. I did listen to the entire Hub Committee meeting the other day and appreciate all of your inputs, and the conversations are really, really good.
Colleen, could you flip to the next one? Because I think this is this is what we should be thinking about, right?
Yes, this is. So, this is what we've asked the hub and you all to think
as
about.
As you're sitting about over the weekend pondering of what to think about, aren't there weekends? I don't know. Anyway, these are some of the things that I think that we want to provide feedback on, please. Thank you very much.
Yes, very much.
Forward.
Okay. Forward.
All right. As usual, we don't give you any time at all, Patrick.
So thank you very much, Colleen and Jennifer. That's very good. Next on our agenda is discussion of the notice of proposed rulemaking related to supplement, not supplant. And for that, I would ask that Nazanin Mohajir and Nelson come to the table.
Pam, where are you going?
I just wanted to ask this lady a question.
Okay, we're going to carry on without you.
Many of you have heard about this. several weeks ago, the USDE released a notice of rulemaking related to supplement, not supplant. We've had a group of folks in the department who are looking at this issue, looking at the proposed rules, and they, Nazi comes to you today with some recommendations, some thoughts related to the rules, and wants to share with those with you now. Oh, sorry.
Hi.
And just to clarify, we do have how much time do we have? Because we have quite a bit more content. We can sort of to have a target of how long to devote to each of the issues.
You have about 30 minutes.
So we need
25 minutes.
Okay. So we
is
need to
okay?
be definitely done by then. Yes.
Is that okay? Does that work? I know we cut you off at the hub meeting, big time.
That's okay.
He is going to be down here at the end of December. I can see this already. Go ahead. Thank you.
Thank you. In response to your request, I'm here to talk about the Title I provision under the statute for supplement, not supplant. And this provision, well, Title I as a whole, the purpose of Title I is to ensure that all children receive an opportunity for, receive a significant opportunity for a fair, equitable, and high quality education. There are numerous ways within the statute that states can demonstrate how we're ensuring that we're meeting this objective of Title I. There was a whole rich conversation around how we ensure equitable access to teachers with certain qualifications. The fiscal requirements is another way that we can ensure that students have that fair, equitable access to high-quality education. There are three different fiscal requirements that help us achieve this objective or help us ensure that LEAs are meeting this objective. Those are supplement, not supplant, maintenance of effort, and the comparability provisions within the statute. The supplement, not supplant, serves the purpose of ensuring that Title I schools receive a fair and equitable share of the state and federal, state and local funds that they would have received minus Title I funds, and that federal funds are not used to replace those funds. The maintenance of effort ensures that before any federal funds are distributed to a local education agency or a school, that they have maintained or received at least from the prior year's sources, the same sources, 90% were provided to them from the same sources. So it's maintaining that level of funding from similar sources across the years to ensure that there's a fair distribution of those funds for those schools. Comparability is to ensure equitable access to resources in that it allows us to look at the services that are received by Title I schools and ensuring that they are comparable to non-Title I schools. Colorado currently uses the full-time employee method and the per-pupil allocations methods to check for comparability. Under the statute, the requirement for, the next couple of slides are, the statutory language is presented on burgundy slides so that we have that context of what it says in statute before we start talking about what it says in the proposed rules. The statute requires just like I said, the requirement stays the same from No Child Left Behind. The statute also, under Every Student Succeeds Act, continues to require that Title I funds are used to add to and not replace any state and local funds. Under No Child Left Behind, the provision, this is where there's a change in statute, the provision used to be that each item or each expense had to be demonstrated to be supplemental. There was three tests that schools had to, or the state could use to test whether schools are meeting this requirement. The first was to ensure that all services, to ask the question, were the services that are paid for by Title I required under any other federal, state, or local laws? So in other words, are the funds being used to meet federal ESEA requirements or NCLB requirements, or are they being used to pay for things that are required under another statute? Were services paid for with non-federal funds in the previous year? So now are we replacing the funds with Title I from previous year that some other funding source paid for? Or are the same services or programs paid by non-federal funds for other schools within the same district? So it's that comparison of how are your state and local funds being distributed to ensure that then federal funds are being supplemental. And it used to be item by item. Under the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, LEAs just now have to demonstrate that they're meeting this requirement by demonstrating how they are allocating state and local funds. That requirement for the individual expenses to be supplemental is no longer there. And that provision was, the statute was written to reduce the burden on LEAs in having to demonstrate item by item. It's taking the whole pot of money and looking at it together to demonstrate that supplementness. Is that a word?
And just to quickly insert, so we already have provisions in place with things that we do to look at district level. So is the district maintaining its level of effort with regard to state and local funds? We do comparability at the school level to make sure that each school receives its equitable share of state and local funds. When school districts apply for Title I, Title II funds, we've spent a lot of time in the past looking at individual proposed expenditures like computers or classroom materials, and really quickly getting into the weeds and engaging in a back and forth like, are you sure that's supplemental and that's not supplanting? This provision in the law is sort of freeing. It gives us the liberty to kind of take us out of that game at the individual and instead look at sort of the broad use of funds across Title I, Title II, Title III together with IDEA. Looking at sort of their general approach to these funds and what they're using them for, as opposed to really getting down to micromanaging how they're spending each and every dollar.
Yeah, so the statute was written such that it would allow us that flexibility and that opportunity to minimize or lower the burden on schools. The statute requires that because the language in the statute was changed under supplement, not supplant, the USDE has the authority to write rules around this. And the statute requires that they hold a negotiated rulemaking, which they did. However, there was lack of consensus as a result of that negotiated rulemaking. And so now they're having to use that secondary process of doing a notice of proposed rulemaking with a 60-day comment period, which is what we're under right now, and what we're going to be talking about, the blue slides will represent the actual rules that have been proposed and our reaction. And our reaction is based on a cross-departmental team of folks that have studied the statute, that have studied the rules. We've met with stakeholders through our committee of practitioner and went through the process with them to see what their reactions were to the rules. And this includes their feedback and their concerns as well. The first part of the rule, our comments are due back to the USDE by November 7th. So the reason we're here today is to share those comments with you and to get your reaction to them as well. The proposed rules, the first thing that they tackle is compliance and how do you demonstrate compliance. They basically restate that LEAs have to demonstrate that they're using state and local funds in an equitable way. However, they add the language, the LEAs must annually publish their methodology. The words in red on this, The words in red are, are additional words that increase the responsibility and burden on the LEAs. So in addition to requiring that they demonstrate to the SEA how they're expending state and local funds, they are now having to publish that methodology in a very public way and do it annually. And so we feel that this is an overreach of the USDE's authority to write regulations around these proposed rules. They're increasing the burden when the statute's intention was to reduce the burden. So our comments back to them around their compliance requirements are that they need to remove, or we are requesting that they remove that requirement of annually publishing the methodology. The next section that they have written rules around are the LEA options, and they very specifically have added terminology that we have concerns that is changing the meaning of the statute. They have added language that says to demonstrate compliance, the local education agencies must distribute almost all state and local funds available to the LEA using four particular options. Those options include distribution of state and local funds based on characteristics of students within the school. So the percentage of students that are qualified for free and reduced lunch would be part of the formula that would be used to determine how to distribute state and local funds. The second part is using a method or a formula for based on personnel and non-personnel resources. The third is the state educational agency has the opportunity to develop methodology that they would like to use and for a compliance test, and those have to be approved by the USDE and peer-reviewed. We don't have to develop such a, under the rules, we don't have to develop, we don't have to take advantage of that option. And even if we do, our districts do not have to use that option. They still have the option of using one, two, or four. And the fourth option is a special rule that allows for use of per pupil formulas to demonstrate the state and local fund distributions. We have several concerns in regards to these four options that are itemized. The first of which is around the language distribute almost all state and local funds. By virtue of adding those, we are concerned that the USDE, if these rules become codified, will be in a position to require a specific amount of those state and local funds. The statute itself was not designed or written to ensure that a certain amount of state and local funds are distributed. It's just that the amounts that are equally distributed between schools.
Do you think that the feds are concerned that some states might use the funds in such a way such that it doesn't travel down all the way to the student? That may be happening, maybe not in this state, but in another state?
That's a really good question, and we'll come back to that, if you don't mind, when we talk about the cost-benefit analyses that the USDE has done, because they address that very notion. So that's our first concern, is by adding that language. The second concern is that within the rules, they have written rules of construction that indicate that nothing in this section shall be construed to require an LEA to transfer of school personnel or require equalization of spending or adoption of a specific methodology. Nor is any part of this statute or rule supposed to alter or otherwise affect local decisions such as memoranda of understanding or collective bargaining agreements. However, our concern is by virtue of itemizing those four options, that there might be occasions where by using one of those four options, LEAs will not have a choice. In order to be in compliance with one of those options, they might have to alter a memorandum of agreement. So our recommendation and our request would be to make those options available through non-regulatory guidance and don't put them into the regulations. When the USDE submits proposed rules, they're required to itemize the or explain the purpose of their proposed rules, and within this particular proposed rules, their explanation is that their intention is to provide clarity on how to demonstrate compliance with ESSA in a less burdensome manner than was previously available under the No Child Left Behind statute. And the statute already has reduced the burden on LEAs, and providing clarity is very critical and important, but again, we feel that that clarity would be better suited for non-regulatory guidance than writing them into rules that then become codified as regulations and carry the weight of the statute or the weight of the law. The second purpose that they list is that it's intended to provide LEAs the flexibility to implement, supplement, not supplant requirements in a manner that accounts for local needs and circumstances while respecting the core purpose of the statute. We feel that respecting the core purpose of the statute is extremely critical. However, by providing those four options, they have created a situation that if a local educational agency is using a methodology that is very effective for ensuring equity, but is not one of those four, then the LEA would be considered out of compliance. So it's very restrictive and is taking away our flexibilities that were afforded us under the statute. The cost and benefits analyses that they've conducted in order to be able to propose these rules is that the USDE has estimated that 90% of LEAs would already be in compliance with the statute. So in other words, they're saying that their indication is that 10% of the LEAs, or they give actually very specific numbers. They say that 1,500 LEAs and 5,750 schools would be out of compliance, which leads us to believe that they already know who those schools and districts are because of how specific those numbers are. They're not telling us somewhere between 5,500 and 6,000 schools might be out of compliance. They're saying 5,750 will be out of compliance. So our response to them is allow the state agencies without regulations that specify those four methodologies to know who those schools and districts are and allow us to work with our districts to then ensure compliance with the statute, as opposed to requiring regulations for 100% of the schools and districts based on 10% being potentially out of compliance. As part of the proposed rules, they have also extended an invitation to comment very specifically on whether they should expand the flexibility available to an LEA that chooses to use option number 4 by including other categories of expenditures. And our response and our comment with some detail back to them will be that using regulations to expand flexibility seems counterproductive, and that that we appreciate the clarity that they've tried to provide with those options and the information that they've put together for us. However, again, those would be better suited for non-regulatory guidance than they would be for regulations, because those regulations, by having those four specific options, are actually limiting our abilities. We also have some general comments that we would like to provide back in regards to the proposed rules altogether, is that those four methodologies that they've provided rely very heavily on funds-driven approaches, which really restricts the LEA's ability to look at the quality of resources that are being distributed, and to ensure that the quality of resources are also equitable across schools. It restricts the flexibility for local decision-making and making sure that all of their local decisions are used in a manner that allows them to meet the compliance of the statute but not have to be one of those four methods. And then finally, we've heard on federal conversations or national conversations, folks referring to these proposed rules as a backdoor approach to regulating other parts of the fiscal requirements, specifically comparability. So the Congress very intentionally did not change any of the wording in comparability. What was in No Child Behind was very verbatim carried forward under Elementary and Secondary Education Act. We believe that was very intentional on their part because they don't want that regulated. And so this, by taking the same strategies that many states use to meet comparability and making them a requirement under supplement, not supplant, our concern is that this is a backdoor approach to trying to regulate comparability for states as well.
All right. Excellent. Wasn't that good? That's a very complicated topic, and I think she did a really nice job of attempting to clarify it in a limited amount of time. Do you guys have any questions on that before we move to the reporting piece?
Go forth with your protest. Oh, I'm sorry, Joyce, go ahead.
I just have a quick question. Remember when you came back right after ESSA was passed and you had an opportunity to read it? It was a day when your head exploded?
I was worried that hers was going to explode just now, but it didn't.
This is the type of thing we discussed. How are the other states that must be having some of these same problems? Are they documenting it and putting forth by November 7th the similar concerns?
Yes, I believe they are. And I also think that some states and have been successful in including Senator Lamar Alexander and Representative Klein in the conversation, those who were actively involved in the drafting of this law, and they too have expressed their concern. That's why the negotiated rulemaking process kind of broke down to begin with, because there were two camps that were diametrically opposed, so they weren't able to agree on the rules. The concern is that if we don't speak up now, that these become rule by default. They have until the end of November, I believe, or they're scheduled to make these final by the end of November. But yeah, we're not alone. There are a number of groups, states, and others who have expressed some concern about this.
So are there any, do you see any others coming forward after these go through, things we may have missed that are going to come back to be a real problem for us? You know, as you say, they're going to become rules if we don't find them. And I'm just so concerned about how the department has been able to make these rules so different from what Congress agreed to.
It's unfortunate that they didn't. So there was actually a language change to the supplement, not supplant provision, but these rules don't even address the actual change. They've written rules about the part of the supplement, not supplant, that didn't change. Mm-hmm. So I do think that because we have been doing comparability, because we've been doing maintenance of effort, that we should move forward thinking that that's sufficient. But when they created these rules, they're enough different from what we've been doing under comparability mm-hmm. to create problems for us.
Thank you for bringing that forward.
Don't you guys think that the government, you know, does have the right, I know, I mean, I believe in local control, but does have the right to look at districts such as Denver Public Schools that has four times as much as many administrators, you know, than does Jefferson County, than does,
well, how, but
where are we going here?
Well, we're going into that the money is not going to students. It's not being spent on students, that it's going for administration and experimentation and any other reasons other than for kids. I mean, I'm sure that one of those 1,500 districts, one of them is Denver.
We know.
So I think the main thing here is that non-Title I schools and Title I schools receive basically the fair share. They want to ensure that districts don't remove funds from Title I schools and replace them with these federal funds. That absent the Title I funds, that the non-Title I and the Title I schools are staffed equitably, the per pupil amounts of funds are equitable, so that they're not really removing state and local funds and replacing them with the federal funds.
So have we shared with Representative Polis this? Because he came and spoke to the HUB committee, and I believe he's still engaged since he was on the compromise committee.
Yeah, I was able to talk to him briefly about this. We have, as a matter of course, have been sending our response to rules to our congressional representatives' offices for their record to know that we are responding. And I did talk to him a little bit about this particular one.
Great.
All right. So,
Jane, sorry.
Oh, thank you. Just a quick add-on comment that yes, we are not alone in our pushback points, coast to coast, NASB members anyway have sure been talking about this is where everybody's focus is, and NASB's been present and active regularly with the department personnel one level or another, along with CCSSO, the state chiefs organizations, PTA, teachers organizations, and all. They've all spent a lot of time together making sure that the messages are not cookie cutter but absolutely in line with what the interpretation of the new law is, and making sure they're aligned as possible. But a couple of points of, I'll just say, contention with the proposals were along the single accountability rating that we talked about a lot, where there was I don't remember the explanation of it, but we had problems with coming out with a single rating when we had been working so hard, and we have what we will change slightly, but basically our system of acknowledging growth and achievement and other parts of our system. But there was also good healthy conversation too around the assessment. The assessment rulemaking process and the high points of things that we've acknowledged as well, which are the benefits of the pilot program and the pilot demonstration authority part of that, but some other really good points that we do all agree with, even though there are 50 different styles of systems for every single one of these points. So by and large, state board members as a group are on the same page in, I'd say, 90% of everything.
And I do think that, we do share the goal that, or the intent that these funds should be supplemental above and beyond state and local effort. Just feel that the rules kind of go beyond the intent of statute and are attempting to sort of micromanage state and local funding decisions in addition to the federal funding decisions. So we want to push back there.
Yeah, well, and we're not alone. We have company in a constructive way, which is good. One other real quick point on that, other things that have been going on concurrently in Congress and at the federal level. The passage of the Career and Tech Ed, the Perkins Act, is promising, may happen during the lame duck session, so we're waiting on that. The other big conversation that at some point may tie in with what we can do is the federal budget, the allocation process. Mm-hmm. Can't say anything one way or the other. It may happen in December. They certainly hope so. The the bargaining ground is between the low of the House amount, the high of the Senate, which is as high as $1 billion. There's more optimism it will go not at the $1 billion level, but higher than the projected really low possible, $300 million, which is kind of a drop in the bucket when it comes to federal program money. So we'll see, but that would be December. I'm done.
Okay. All right. So do we want to quickly go through reporting and then skip the last part, or do we want to, or do we just need to?
No, I think we're going to do 10 more minutes of reporting, if that's okay, and then skip the last part, but maybe you guys could read as homework or pre-work for the next time the title slides, because that'll give you a good grounding for some of that funding. But we did want to at least share a little bit of the reporting so you're not surprised by that.
And then when you do read all the we gave you a number of handouts, sort of fact sheets related to the title programs, and then there are some slides in there about the amounts of money that we're talking about. If you have anything, any questions when you read those, just let Commissioner Anthus or Busy know, and we'll try to incorporate that into our presentation for next month.
And if you're having problems falling asleep,
go through those
title things.
Yeah, we realize it's not exactly the most exciting. But.
Well,
and then so Nazi is going to do her best, just kind of skip through, pull out the highlights, and if your head starts to explode, let us know, and I can take over.
Okay, thank you. or if you see anyone nodding off and going to sleep, feel free to jump in. So we had the privilege of coming and discussing with you our comments back to the USCE in regards to the notice of proposed rulemaking on the ESSA state plan and accountability and reporting. So on August 1st, we did submit our comments in response to that, and that part and those rules included the federal part of federal reporting requirement, that is the public facing reporting. So what we have to report to the public, and LEAs have to report to the public. What we're here to talk to you today about are the proposed changes for the second part of federal reporting, and that is that.
Oops.
Thank you. And that is the state agency's requirements to report to the federal government. So. Just real briefly and basically, the structure of this this part of the PowerPoint is that the forward-facing or the public reporting requirements are spelled out on burgundy slides, and the proposed changes or the statutory requirements for the reporting to the USDE are on green slides, and the blue slides are again the proposed changes, and that's what we'd like to talk to you guys about. So we put in the requirements for state reporting and LEA reporting for the public on the burgundy slides for your reference. I'm going to skip those since we've already talked to you guys about that and have submitted our comments. Under the ESSA statute, we also have to do reporting to the USDE, any LEA or any SEA that accepts funds under the Elementary and Secondary Education Act has to provide reports to the USDE in regards to demonstrate how we have spent those funds, what's the return on investment, and how have we, what are the accountability results, what are assessment results, how have we used those funds. We also include things about how which one of our schools are on improvement under the statute, and what are the professional qualifications of teachers. So all of the reporting that was covered in the earlier session.
Do you think anybody reads them?
Yes, ma'am, I do.
Okay, just curious.
Yeah. They actually use that information to provide reports to Congress. They're very lagged, but Congress does see the impact of the dollars, and they use that information in making continued funding.
Super.
So.
Okay.
Just real quickly, the authority for collecting this data comes from 34 Code of Federal Regulations, which authorizes the USDE to collect performance reports, financial reports, and any other required reports from states, districts, and schools, as long as they have approval from the Federal Office of Management and Budget, who we very affectionately call the OMB. Our failure to submit the reports as prescribed by the USDE once an OMB package has been approved is considered a violation of the General Education Provisions Act and could jeopardize our federal funding, all of it. So not just ESEA, but just all of our federal funding. So meeting these reporting requirements is extremely important and heavy for two reasons. One, it jeopardizes our funding. Then the latter use of the data to provide back to Congress how states are spending those funds and what impact they're having with them.
Excuse me, just a little interruption. We just got that report from the U.S. Department of Education, which cited that if a student, a minority student, or poor student lived in Jefferson County, that student won the lottery in the whole United States. In other words, students in Jefferson County who are poor, who are minority, do better than any other district in the whole country if they go to school in Jefferson County, which was not, I'm sorry.
I know, I'm just trying to understand what you're telling us.
Well, that if they went,
this was the result of this information. We really need to keep moving.
Well, it is from the result of this. Okay. It just came out that report
from last year.
I'm not sure that it was last year. I heard just part of that, but yeah, that is the kind of thing that happens with this data.
Right, and so that was really outstanding that we have Jefferson County.
All right.
You can share that with us, Patrick. When
it's an interesting point.
So that's a nice segue to that federal. So we wanted to give you some context about what does that federal reporting look like in practice. What is it that we submit each year to the USDE? We do submit state level, district level, and school level data files to the USDE that include all of our assessment results. Overall and disaggregated at the student level, because they do track our performance of our students that are English learners or minority students or eligible for free and reduced lunch. We provide our results of our state accountability and including which schools are identified for improvement. They do monitor how long we keep schools on improvement across the years and information like that to determine how fast we're moving schools. They also look at our school improvement strategies and qualifications of teachers, how we're distributing teachers across our schools, and whether students have been disproportionately are being disproportionately taught by any teacher who isn't considered to be effective or qualified or experienced. I'm sorry, that was probably poor choice. That's not their words. How we are ensuring that students,
equitable distribution of teachers.
Equitable distribution.
There is a provision in the law that does prohibit the U.S. Department of Education from requiring states or school districts to move teachers around.
Right.
So there is a little bit of protection there.
How would we do that?
Yeah.
But you have to report. And
you
I think you have to ensure that
students
to have more equity in that school. And then
school boards ask for the same thing, large school district. Large school districts ask for the same information. They want to know that there's some equitable distribution in terms of teacher experience and teacher degrees, number of hours, et cetera, across schools. I do remember that that was a report that we got every year in our school district.
So what's being checked for is that our schools that have a higher rate of poverty or higher rate of minority students aren't within a district getting all of the new teachers hired at that school, whereas the experienced teachers, so it's not like the stepping stone into getting into that district. You work at the high poverty school first and then get promoted to a different school. So it's protecting against those.
Which it was.
So maybe distribution of teachers is poor choice of words on my part. It's just ensuring that we're not hiring.
That woke me up.
Yeah.
A few years ago,
That's why she said it, yeah.
Distribution of teachers.
The report said, this is
we have a bus,
report,
and we drive around the state.
Cherry Creek did a better job of doing that than any other district in the state, not this
of
last year.
Of distributing teachers?
Of having an equitable distribution of experience.
Yeah. I know. So we do have, the number of collections varies by year, and the collections are lagged 1 year. So we're currently working on the 15-16 collection, or reporting for next year. We've really sifted through the thousands of pages of proposed changes. This is the USDE's efforts to align their collections with the Every Student Succeeds Act statute, and so they have deleted numerous collections, which included anything to do with NCLB or waiver accountability, for example. So AYP collections have all been eliminated. Anything to do with AMAOs or AMOs, which were all under NCLB accountability, have all been eliminated. They've made revisions to things to fine-tune some of the definitions within the collections to align with ESSA. So, for example, the students used to be called limited English proficient students, and that was part of the collections. They are now called English learners under ESSA. So those have been, the revisions are all about aligning those terminology. The elements that they're continue to collect include things like grad rate and dropout rates, which were part of NCLB reporting and will continue to be under ESSA as well. They are also proposing to add some requirements that were specified in statute. So we are now required to report to the USDE per pupil expenditures within funding sources by federal, state, and local. And we are also required to report information about students that are foster children and students of active military families. So those additions include those new data elements and data reporting requirements.
And homeless too, isn't it?
Homeless was always there.
Oh, it was always there? Mm-hmm. Oh, sorry. Mm-hmm.
Didn't know that.
So we have some general comments that we would like to propose back to send back to the USDE, and they center around the sheer volume of the reporting requirements. We're taking advantage of this opportunity that they are trying to align with ESSA to give them feedback and input on the burden on our local educational agencies as well as the state agency to talk about. Please use this opportunity to review and minimize any duplication of collections so that it can reduce the burden on our LEAs. And we also, the last point is that the USDE really underestimated the amount of effort and resources that it takes as part of their proposed rules. They have to make an estimation of what it costs to collect this. And we feel that their estimation is hugely underestimated. So we'd like to provide back because, again, we want the OMB to recognize the amount of work that it takes for us to, as a state, including our LEAs, to meet these reporting requirements. So we're using this opportunity to also provide estimates as to what that burden really is or that lift is for the state. And in order for us to meet the timelines in the OMB package, we have to start taking making speculations about what's coming down. The specifications have not been released yet. So in order for us to meet those timelines, we need to build systems now for collecting these additional requirements, and we're kind of taking a guess as to what that's going to look like, and we're building systems around that, and we're anticipating that once those specifications are released by the USDE, we will have additional work to do. So we want that to be taken into consideration as they move forward, that that's additional burden on the LEAs and the SEAs in meeting these reporting requirements.
So I think they estimated this takes one person to do this.
For each state agency.
One person for each state agency to accomplish
18-20 hours a day, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you guys have any questions or feedback, any direction that you'd like to give us moving forward on this issue?
So again, here's the questions and feedback. You might want to look at this over the weekend when you have your feet up.
Are
you looking for something to think about?
Yeah, I just have one thing.
We don't know what they're going to require, yet do we have to figure out how much time this is going to cost LEAs and SEAs to provide the information, even when we don't have what their requirements
that's
are?
It's a little bit difficult. I do think that not, you have thought about that, like you, she's been trying to estimate what it might be to give that as part of the feedback, that no, and it's not just one person, actually it's this many people and this many hours to accomplish.
And that's with the requirements that are specified in statute and the requirements in the proposed rules, not including, and what we'd like to say is that we anticipate that there's going to be even additional work once the USDE releases those specifications in regards to, like, the definitions and the requirements for how to submit this data to them.
Is that going to be done after they get all this input on the 7th, and then they sort through that, then they give us what? Is there some way we are going to provide some kind of a template for the districts to ease the burden?
That's part of what, when so in working with our spoke committees and stakeholders and so forth, we're trying to get at, with particularly some of the smaller, more rural districts, how we can provide support to them or create templates or other tools that they can use or we can use together to help minimize the burden, particularly on those districts. Mm-hmm. But I do think that there's something that maybe we can do with all districts to try to
simplify,
because it is a little bit predictable. We know what we'll have to report, and so how can we ease the burden of this?
Okay, good. Thank you.
We're trying our best to use existing systems, existing data collections to meet any new additional requirements, for the state to do as much calculations as we can, and even the public-facing report cards. We are going to try to continue. It has been our practice that we do those LEA report cards on behalf of the districts, and we'd like to continue that practice, even though the statute does say that any additional data that the districts would like to add, they can add to their report cards. So we're trying to figure out the best way that we can provide that initial template with the data and then allow them to add any additional information that they would like to add. But to do that lift for them.
So this administrative burden that the state has and the local does not come out of the federal funding, is that correct?
This reporting that we're talking about right now?
Yes.
Oh, you mean our ability to meet it?
Yes.
Well,
yes.
We get some administrative funding, and people who are paid with that administrative funding are among those who are helping to produce these required reports.
Is it enough for these new?
I would argue no.
So can we put that into that November 7th report?
I think we are trying to capture that point.
Good.
May I just say that, I mean, yesterday's report, California was kind of up on this, on the reporting of the, not assessment, but for assessing how much it was going to cost for them to really do the reporting on how much, in assessing universities and whether they were going to do their work. The U.S. Department is giving them $25 million. They said it was going to cost them $285,000 just, you know, starting out, and then every year it was going to cost so much. So it's back to what ESA was before, where they made the law but they didn't provide the monies for how much it was going to cost. And I think we need to do a job analysis of all, you know, that is costing, and possibly even estimate a medium-sized district, a small district, a large district, and how much, you know, all that is going to cost, because it's they have no idea.
Oh, yeah.
The feds don't have it.
They do.
No, they just want to leave it and give it to the states and let the states spend the monies, which we just don't have.
That's a good report.
Yeah. Excellent report, you guys.
Thank you very much. So,
all of you.
Read
Thank
your
you.
Title
it's really helpful.
Information.
Yeah, we'll be reading this all weekend long.
If you want to, you know, call me in the middle of the night with questions because you can't get to sleep.
No. No.
We can read it together.
No.
Thank you very much, you guys.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I really appreciate it. All right, we're on the home stretch. We have one more hearing.
And this is rules for the annual inspection and preventive maintenance of school transportation vehicles. One CCR 301-29. The State Board voted to, to approve the notice of rulemaking at its August 10th, 2016 board meeting. A hearing to promulgate these rules was made known through publication of a public notice on August 25, 2016 through the Colorado Register and by State Board notice October 5th. Oh, yay. The State Board is authorized to promulgate these rules pursuant to 22-2-1071C CRS. Commissioner, is staff prepared to provide an overview? By the way, this is Groundhog Day.
Correct. This is Groundhog Day.
And I get to talk about my 18-year-olds again, drivers again?
You do, if you would like to.
No, I'll probably be killed, so I might not.
Okay, yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll turn it over to Jennifer Oakes to remind us about why this is Groundhog Day.
Okay. Jennifer Oakes, School Finance. So I'll keep this brief, but please let me know if you have any questions. So what we want to do with this rulemaking is to repeal in full the 29 and then repeal and reenact 26 to consolidate these two rules. So one was on preventative maintenance and one was on annual inspection, and those are very linked together, so we think it's more clear and concise if they're combined together. We're trying to clarify the rules and make them more clear for districts to better understand them, and then you'll get better compliance. And then we are also trying to consolidate, and if it's duplicative of statute, we've taken those out. But then what we've done is created a comprehensive resource guide that encompasses everything so that you could look at one place and see federal requirements and state law and the regulations. So there's kind of a one-stop shop. So it's just really to streamline and clarify. Since it's Groundhog Day, but we have a good opportunity, we did find one change that we'd like to propose in doing our outreach and regional trainings. We had great discussions with districts about really specifics about the details. And a couple of those questions led us to come back and meet with the Rail Transit Safety Section Chief of the Public Utilities Commission and ask a couple questions that came up from districts about railroad crossings. And so because of that clarification that we got from her, we would like to make a change. It's to Rule 1714 in your packet. And what we want to do is just clarify that there's, and this is in statute as well, and we did have it in the rules because we want it to apply not just to school buses, but the activity buses and then the motor coach buses. And so it's, you do not need to stop at a railroad crossing if there's only a red, yellow, green light and nothing else. And that wasn't clear in the statute. So if there's the double X, the railroad crossing crossbars, or any type of railroad crossing for the tracks and a red light, you still need to stop and look to make sure no trains are crossing. If there's no signage except that red, yellow, green, then you can just proceed if the light is green. And so that was clarification. So we want to add the word only. And then we have some nice little guidance about what does that look like in our resource guide. So we think that's helpful clarification. And then we also wanted to include some words about you do not need to stop if there's an exempt sign. And that's, there's only a handful of railroad crossings in the state that has an exempt sign, which is the white sign that says exempt, and it has to be on that sign with the crossbars on it. Those have been marked as exempt. And there's a few probably in the state that we realized because of these questions that should be or could be exempt, and so we're getting the districts in contact with the proper folks.
Under what circumstances do you have an exempt railroad crossing? No railroad?
So there
no
is...
No train?
That would be when you might have the railroad that is still going across the street, but...
Train the, using it anymore.
Yeah, and in some cases, the railroad lines downstream and upstream from that crossing have been, pulled up, and so it's just abandoned track.
Okay.
But if it doesn't have that exempt sign, even though you know it's abandoned, you still need to stop and look. But we're getting some of those districts when they know that's the case and it's not a workable because it's not connected to anything else, we're working with them to get the exempt sign, if that makes sense.
Okay.
What does the exempt sign look like?
The exempt sign, and it's kind of little, but maybe, so you can see the little crossbars that says railroad crossing. This is the exempt sign.
So it actually says exempt.
It says exempt. And it's white, which means that's a regulatory, and so that's...
All going to hunt the state of Colorado.
There's only a handful, so...
That's right, but it's a cut.
States, and I've seen all of the exempt sign. Crossing
yes.
Where they all are in my own.
So we just want to do that clarification.
So we expect a list of those with location, please.
We can get that for you.
I can assure you there's nowhere
near Larkspur. You're so bad. I'm so bad. I'm teasing.
Then there was some public comments that we also received from Scott Lamb, who's the Fleet Operations and Maintenance Specialist at Academy 20. And his is essentially that he's concerned that we had a list of all of the items that needed to be looked at during the annual inspection, and we had replaced that with you need to inspect all of the items listed on that form, and it's a form that goes to the EDAC committee. We would recommend not making that change just because it's cumbersome to have two or three pages of
he wants
details.
That in, he's requested that be put in the rules?
That we put that listing back into the rules.
And you're advising against that?
And we think that that's not necessary. We don't think it's going to change very much, but if technology changes, it's easier to change a form and present that to EDAC. Than having to go through rulemaking, and until you go through rulemaking. So we don't anticipate any changes to that, really, but it's just a streamlining process. So either way is fine. We just think that this is maybe a more streamlined approach.
Okay. Is that okay with everybody?
Yeah.
All right. Well, first we have to hear if there are any, or there aren't any speakers, right? Is there anyone here to speak to these rules? Going, gone. Yes, please. I would love to have a motion.
I move to repeal the rules for the annual inspection and preventative maintenance of school transportation vehicles, 1 CCR 301-29.
That's a proper motion. Thank you for the second. Does anyone object? Yay. All right. Well, thank you.
You could do it again.
I need to be ready for this next time.
There is no ready. There is no ready for somebody who pounds that thing. It's designed to wake us up. Colorado State Board of Education will now conduct a public rulemaking hearing for the rules for the operation, maintenance, and inspection of school transportation vehicles, 1 CCR 301-26. The State Board voted to approve the notice of rulemaking at its August 10, 2016 board meeting. A hearing to promulgate these rules was made known through the publication of a public notice on August 25th, 2016, through the Colorado Register, and by State Board notice on October 5, 2016. State Board is authorized to promulgate these rules pursuant to 22-2-107-1C-CRS. Commissioner.
Yes, Ms. Oakes, do you have anything to add? This is just part two of what we talked about.
This is part two, unless you have questions.
Do you want to say it all over again? No. Okay. Any comments? Is there anyone here to testify? Is there anybody here who dares to testify?
Is there anyone here?
And I am ready for that. I am ready for that motion, ma'am.
I move to approve the amended rules for the operation, maintenance, and inspection of school transportation vehicles, 1 CCR 301-26.
Second.
Proper motion, proper second. Thank you. You got to vote, and then you can hammer. Ma'am, you got to vote.
Oh, we got to vote. Oh.
Bring my own.
Are you calling
your pants?
He said, ma'am.
Ma'am. Oh, ma'am.
Does anyone object to that motion? Thank you. You want a hammer? Oh, wait a minute. Wait. Does the State Board have any future business to discuss at this time? You guys have been wonderful, really. Go. Thank you. We are now in recess until November 9th, 2016.